It's half past eight.
It's half past eight, New York time. Time to wake up America and stump the experts. Each week at this time, Lucky Strike sets up a quiz quartet that knows, well, not all, but most of the answers. For every question we use, Lucky Strike pays out $10 plus a copy of the new Information Please quiz book. If your question stumps us, you get $25 more plus a 24-volume set of the current Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your questions to Information Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. If our editorial staff edits your questions a bit, don't fret over it. In case of duplication, Information Please uses the question that was received first, and all questions become the property of Information Please. And now light up a lucky strike as I present our master of ceremonies, the literary critic of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, Information Please is a completely unrehearsed, spontaneous, and ad-lib program. We welcome back tonight, with much hey-ho, our wandering expert, Oscar Levant, fresh from recent triumphs in Hollywood. And the other two members of the trio are, of course, on hand, the eminent maestro of sports and what have you, Mr. John Kieran, and the equally eminent and lyrical conductor of the New York Post's Conning Tower, Mr. Franklin P. Adams. And by the way, a book of nature notes by John Kieran, titled John Kieran's Nature Notes, is out today, and you may run, not walk, to your nearest bookstore. Is that all right, John?
That's fine.
Okay. Now, our guest tonight is the world-famous sculptor and raconteur, Mr. Joe Davidson, who happens, by the way, to be the fourth bearded marvel that we have had on this program. Can any of you gentlemen name the other three, by the way? Mr. Levant.
Monty Woolley.
Monty Woolley was one. Mr. Kieran.
Rex Stout.
And Mr.
Christopher
Davidson.
Morley and Chris Kringle.
Chris Kringle. We never had Chris Kringle on this program.
Yes, we did. We were on Christmas night once.
I don't remember. You must have been seeing double.
He was here in spirit.
Remember, listeners, for each question that we miss, Lucky Strike rings up $25. And that's paid out to the sender, plus 24 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. So much for introduction. Now, we'll start the program this evening with a question coming to us from Dora Harkins of Providence, Rhode Island. Can you give four popular bits of advice in which the use of some part of the body is mentioned? For example, keep your nose to the grindstone. Mr. Adams.
Keep your shirt on.
Keep your shirt on is a very good one. Mr. Levant.
Keep your nose clean.
Keep your nose clean is a very good one, Mr. Levant. Mr. Adams again.
Pull down your vest.
Pull down your vest. What does that mean exactly?
Doesn't mean anything. It's an old expression means be careful.
I think that's what it means, yes. Mr. Kieran?
Don't carry a chip on your shoulder.
Don't carry a chip on your shoulder is a very good one. That gives us four, and one could think of others. Chin up, shoulder to the wheel, don't stick your neck out, toe the mark, and so forth.
And who wears the pants?
Who wears the pants? Well, that was just to start us off. The next one is a little more difficult. It comes from S.G. Pratt of New York City. And I think it is particularly directed at Mr. Davidson. But the rest of you boys can come in on this. What sculptor, there are three questions, get two out of three. What sculptor created a statue that embarrassed the mayor of a large city? Mr. Davidson.
McMoney's Civic Virtue.
That's right. What was the matter with that statue, Mr. Davidson?
Some didn't like it.
And which mayor did it embarrass?
Highland, I believe?
Yes, Highland. That was quite some time ago, in 1919. I don't know who called the statue atrocious art, but somebody did. Possibly Mr. Highland himself, who doubling as an art critic at the time. What's happened to civic virtue since then, Mr. Davidson?
I believe it has been removed.
And no one can see it now?
Oh, yes.
You can? Where is it?
I believe it's going to some museum.
It's going to Brooklyn.
Civic virtue in Brooklyn?
Yes.
Why should it be localized in just one borough?
I don't know. The transportation charges are $28,000.
Things you know, Mr. Adams. Well, that's correct.
You're going to pay it out of your own pocket, Frank?
Now, which sculptor, gentlemen, was prosecuted because he did not give a statue its due amount of gold? I imagine that Mr. Davis.
Phidias, I believe.
Yes, Phidias. That was in how long ago and when was it?
Oh, Age of Pericles, I believe.
Yes, far, far back in the age of the classic Greek times. He was accused of embezzling some gold that was provided for the statue. What statue was that? Do you know, Mr. Davidson?
I believe it was a bas relief, which is now in the British Museum.
And whom did it represent?
It represented, I believe he had a head of Pericles on that.
I think it was Athena.
Yes, but he went to jail for having carved a portrait of Pericles on it, which was considered not done.
I see. All right, good. Now, what is the answer to the third one? What sculptor's work was rescued from a warehouse by the pennies of the children of New York? Mr. Adams.
The Bartholdi statue, or better known as the Statue of Liberty.
Yes, that's right. It lay in a warehouse and needed a pedestal before it could be set up, and the children of the city contributed their pennies, and it was set up.
To the offices, I believe, of the New York World.
How long ago was that, Mr. Adams?
I think it was around the 80s.
As long ago as that. Well, that gives us 3 out of 3 on sculpture. The next one is from R.C. Angel of Buffalo. Get 2 out of 3. In what movie or play is there a quotation from the following? First, from Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. In what movie or play is that used? Mr. Levant.
Charles Ruggles. Isn't Charles Ruggles?
No, it's Charles...
Charles Lawton.
Yeah.
Ruggles of Lawton Gap. Red Gap.
Yes, and Ruggles of Red Gap. That's right. Recited the whole address, did he not?
Yeah.
And very movingly. That's quite right. Now, in what movie or play is there a quotation from the balcony scene, from Romeo and Juliet? Mr. Levant again.
That was Hepburn in her first picture. Second picture.
The Morning Glory.
The
Morning Glory. Very good. That gives you 2 out of 2, Mr. Levant. Now, in what movie or play is there a musical quotation, which I shall ask you not to sing or hum, if you don't mind, from Stars and Stripes Forever? Where was that used? Mr. Kieran.
I think in Arsenic and Old Lace, isn't it?
I haven't seen it, so I don't know.
Why would it be in there?
I don't think it is.
Isn't it used as a bugle?
I don't believe so.
Oh, no.
No, it was used where?
Well, I used it as an exit march in protest in a play. It was kind of to help things along at the final curtain.
What play?
But it wasn't a part of the play.
No.
Kaufman would be angry if I said it was in that show.
Oh, we mustn't get him angry.
American Way.
the one I was thinking of was Of Thee I Sing. I think it uses a march in Of Thee I Sing. Remember that now, Mr.
Levant? In Wintergreen. That's
right.
I won't sing.
That gives us one wrong, but that was all we were required to get 2 out of 3, which we did. Now, the next one comes from Dr. H. Shapiro of the Museum of Natural History of this city. Again, get 2 out of 3 if you can. With what group of people is the following dietary peculiarity associated? The first peculiarity is the eating of earth. The eating of earth. Who eats earth? What tribe or group of people? Mr. Davidson? I beg pardon?
Sculptor.
Well, you must be thinking of your early days, Mr. Davidson.
Still at it.
Still at it?
You don't mean the Indians and the Indian stories that bite the dust?
No. What thing of those? I don't think they use it as a steady diet, Mr. Adams. No, the...
corpses.
I beg pardon, Mr. Levant?
Corpses.
Corpses?
That's pretty necrophilia.
No, I don't think so. Mr. Kieran, would you care to guess for us?
Parsees.
No, I don't think so.
I give up.
How about some bad lettuce?
Maybe the Parsees do. Certain Persian groups and do, as a matter of fact. The Melanesians and Indians of the South Seas, Javanese, Dyaks of Borneo, all apparently eat earth. Who eats rotten fish? I think the way it looks at the level now, Mr. Davidson.
You mean when you know it or if you don't know it?
No, by preference, Mr. Levant.
Seals.
Yes, I suppose seals do. I was thinking of human groups. The Chinese and the Eskimos apparently both like rotten fish when obtainable. And who eats insects, gentlemen? Insects.
Rats.
Can't you just bring us onto a human level, Mr. Levant?
Well, it's not normal to think of anybody eating insects.
Oh, I don't know, Mr. Kieran.
Well, the tribes in Africa eat locusts.
Yes, I think that would be considered an insect. The Australian Aborigines and the Japanese apparently eat insects, too. That gives us only 1 out of 3. And sends $25, courtesy of Lucky Strike, to Dr. Shapiro, professor of the Botanical. And the next question comes from Doris Hansen of Hollywood, California. You get 3 out of 4 if you can. What is the present position of these Americans who once held the offices that I'll now read? Now, the first one was a governor, was head of the Social Security Board, and a member of the International Labor Office. What position does he hold now, Mr. Adams?
Ambassador to the Court of St. James's.
That's correct. And the gentleman in question?
John Winant.
That's quite right. Mr. Levant?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Thanks, old fellow.
You boys are working together beautifully tonight. Now, in the next case, The gentleman was a governor. He was a governor general, and he was a cabinet secretary. What position does he hold now? Who is it? Mr. Levant.
Supreme Court Judge Murphy.
That's quite correct, yes. When he was in the cabinet, he held what position?
The one that Jackson has now.
Attorney General, I think it was. Right. And when he was governor general, he was governor general of what?
The Philippines. Everybody seems to have been governor general.
Here's another. He was an editor and a cabinet member. What is he now? And who is he? An editor and then a cabinet member. Mr. Curran.
Ambassador to Mexico.
Who would that be?
The Secretary of the Navy.
Daniels.
Yeah. Josephus Daniels is correct, and there's still another answer.
Henry Wallace.
Henry Wallace, yes, was an editor and a cabinet member, of course. Now, the fourth was an admiral, a governor general. What is he now?
Ambassador.
Mr. Davidson?
Ambassador Vichy.
Ambassador to Vichy, and you're referring to?
Admiral Leahy.
Admiral Leahy, yes. He was Governor General of Puerto Rico. Well, that gives us 4 out of 4, gentlemen. See what you can do with this one. From Mrs. Winifred H. Bennett of Portland, Maine. You're going to try to identify the following sounds by naming the poems from which they're taken. Now, if you don't mind, I'm going to be the sound effects man. Is that all right, Mr. Adams? Here is the first sound. Get 2 out of 3. Clot, 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 clot. So you have 2 hands. Mr. Curran.
That is the clot, 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 clot of the horse on which the highwayman rode in Alfred Noy's poem of that name.
Gee, I'm good. That's quite right.
I thought that was Paul Revere's horse.
I can do with Paul Revere's horse, too, Mr. Adams.
Clot, clot again?
It's a little different. Now, here's another one. He tinkledy, bingledy, winkled a bell. He tinkledy, bingledy, winkled a bell. Any ideas? What poem does it come from?
Bells. Those words?
Mm-hmm. Those words, yes, Mr. Curran. Mr. Adams.
What poem would mm-hmm. that be? That mm-hmm. might be The Bells by Edgar Allan Poe. Mm-hmm.
That's what Mr. Levant said. I think not. It doesn't sound like a Poe line. It's from The Pobble Who Has No Toes by Edward Lear. And when boats or ships came near him, he tinkledy-binkledy winkled a bell so that all the world could hear him. You find this a bit childish, Mr. Davidson?
No.
Here's another. Here's another. Now I have to get the next one right. The next one is a bit more serious. Twee, tweedledee, tweedledee. Mr. Levant.
Is that tweedledee, tweedledum?
Nope.
Well, why did you call on me?
Because the music, the answer involves a knowledge of music. It's from Old King Cole. Every fiddler, he had a fine fiddle, and a very fine fiddle had he. Remember it?
Yeah.
Gives us 2 wrong out of 3, and that makes a lucky strike for Mrs. Bennett and a set of the Britannica. Thank you. Now, lucky strike announces so far a loss of $50 and 2 sets of the Britannica. Now, Mr. Cross shows us how to talk turkey about tobacco.
The only way to talk turkey about tobacco, Mr. Fatiman, is to talk facts. And the facts are that Lucky Strike consistently pays higher prices to get the finer, the lighter, the naturally milder tobaccos. Now, smokers, let me give you one example. Here are the season's totals from the important burley tobacco market of Springfield, Kentucky. At auctions in Springfield, the American Tobacco Company paid 30% more per pound for the tobacco it bought for its cigarettes and other tobacco products. Yes, 30% above the average market price paid for all the various types and grades of tobacco sold there. And the best we bought will go to Lucky's. Now, I could quote season's totals from market after market, and they'd all add up to this one fact. Lucky Strike wants and pays for and gets the finer, the lighter, the naturally milder leaf. Have you tried a Lucky lately?
Mr. Cross, you talk turkey in just 54 seconds. And now we go on with the second half of the program with a question coming from Anna Lee of this city. Now, there are 3 parts to this question. It's a musical question, and you have to get all 3 parts right. You're going to hear some snatches of classic dance music. What dance does each one represent? Is that clear? Let's have the first. That's all you're going to hear. Mr. Levant?
That's a mazurka.
That is a mazurka. By the way, do you know from what composition that those notes were taken?
Not at all.
It's pretty tough. Very little of it was played. Apparently a mazurka by Liszt. And now the second.
Don't you want to know why it's a mazurka?
Yes, I'd love to know why it's a mazurka. Tell us why.
You don't want knowledge, you want answers.
No, I'd love to know why. What does the mazurka mean?
Well, the accent's on the weak or second beat, characteristically.
And you think I know more now than I did before.
Well, you're not the only one listening in.
What's the national derivation of a mazurka?
Polish.
Polish? All right, now shall we listen to the next? Mr. Levant had his hand up at once. I'd like to get it from somebody. Mr. Levant?
It's a very famous Bach piece. It's in the Partita in B-flat, I think the most famous of Bach. It's not a tune that's going to set your feet dancing. It's a sarabande.
It's a sarabande, yes. What sort of dance would that be?
The derivation, I think, is Spanish, but very old, and it's, I think, has a religious connotation, and I'm not sure, but nobody dances to it.
Well, it's a rather stately, dignified.
It's ornamental, too. It's, yeah.
That's quite right. Very
so
cool.
Stately, you don't put your feet down at all.
Good enough. That gives us 2 out of 2. And now we'll have the third of these dance forms. I think that's perhaps the easiest of them, wouldn't you say, Mr. Levant?
Yeah, Mr. Adams or Mr. Kieran ought to get that.
I kind of think that...
The waltz.
It's a waltz, yes.
It's quite a little fast.
It's a plain, ordinary waltz. That gives us 3 out of 3. Thank you very much. Now, here's another one from...
You want to know the character of a waltz.
I would. I'd love to know the character.
I'm kidding.
Only you've got to explain it in such a way that I can understand.
Well, a waltz is something you dance when you can't dance anything else.
That makes it all clear. This one from Elmer Gustafson of Tulsa, Oklahoma. Is about poetry. Get 2 out of 3 if you can. Give the well-known lines, at least it says here that they're well-known, that immediately precede the lines that I'm now going to quote. 1. And gather honey all the day from every opening flower. Mr. Kieran.
How doth the busy little bee improve the shining hour?
Each shining hour.
Each shining hour, as Mr. Adams says. I think there's one tiny error in the first line. How doth the little busy
little
bee?
That's
what I said.
Yeah. You know, you said busy little bee. I'll play the record back. That's good enough, Mr. Kieran. And who wrote it?
Isaac Watts.
Isaac Watts. You don't know what number that song was in his collected works.
No, he wrote a great one.
Who would? Number 20. Here's another. Antigiousness, the limbs and outward flourishes. I will be brief. What's the line that comes before that? That's not easy. Mr. Kieran.
I think that is Polonius, isn't it?
You bet it is. That's right, Mr. Kieran.
Since brevity is the soul of wit.
That's exactly right, Mr. Kieran. That's pretty good, picking that out. I think most of us would know the phrase, since brevity is the soul of wit, but we wouldn't be able to go on with it and know the next 2 lines, as Mr. Kieran did. Here's the third, and I think the hardest of them. Thou art not my friend, and I'm not thine.
Take it easy.
That's a tough one. What's the one that comes before that? Does it strike a responsive chord in the memories of any of you? Well, it comes from a poem by Ralph Waldo Emerson called Goodbye, and the line that comes before it is...
Goodbye, proud world.
That's right, Mr. Adams. Goodbye, proud world, I'm going home. Mr. Kieran got it, too, just at the end.
One of the worst poems he wrote.
I know, but we want to give it a chance on this program, along with Shakespeare. That gives us 2 out of 3. The next one from Sylvia Vale of this city, get 3 out of 4. We recently celebrated Lincoln's birthday, so this question is still more or less timely. Who made the statue of Lincoln that's in the following places? Who made the one that is in Washington? In Washington, D.C., Mr. Davidson.
Daniel Chester French.
Daniel Chester French, that's right. And who made the Lincoln statue that is now in Lincoln Park, Chicago? Mr. Adams.
Augustus St. Gaudens.
That's quite right. And the one that is on Mount Rushmore. On Mount Rushmore. Mr. Adams?
George Gray Barnard. Gutz and Borglum.
Yes. Yeah. Gutz and Borglum. You want me to forget that about Mr. Barnard, don't you? Gutz and Borglum is right. It's one of those enormous...
My little chum whispered that to me. It's wrong.
Why, Mr. Davis.
That's in fact.
Mr. Davidson, you know, Mr. Adams is one of the most suggestible of people.
That's what I like about him.
He'll say anything you whisper to him.
Splendid.
Gutz and Borglum, of course. One of those great, gigantic heads that are being sculptured out on Mount Rushmore. Now, who made the statue of Lincoln that is in London? Mr. Davis.
George Gray Barnard.
This time, sir.
According to my information,
that you get it yet.
According to my information, that's not true, Mr. Davidson. The one that's in London is also an Augustus St. Gordon's statue. It's a copy of the Lincoln Park statue.
But there is one of Barnard's.
There is one of Barnard's. Where does it stand in London?
That I'm sorry I can't tell you.
Well, I'm positive that you must be right, as well as myself. That gives us 4 out of 4.
Gives us 5 out of 4.
That gives us 5 out of 4. Thank you, Mr. Levant. And sends us on to this one from John E. Olson of Wildwood, New Jersey. Again, get 3 out of 4 if you can. Now, these four men were at the top in their respective professions. Who succeeded each one? The first is James Garfield, President James Garfield. Who succeeded him? Mr. Kieran.
Chester A. Arthur.
Chester A. Arthur, yes. Could you give us a date on it?
1881.
That's right, Mr. Adams. Mr. Kieran is probably just about to say that. That's fine. Now, who succeeded Robert Bridges as Poet Laureate? Robert Bridges as Poet Laureate. Mr. Adams?
John Masefield.
John Masefield in 1930. Now, who succeeded Edward D. White as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court? Mr. Levant.
William Howard Taft.
That's quite right, in 1921. And who succeeded Max Schmeling as heavyweight champion? Mr. Kieran?
Do you want it, Oscar?
Take the second half. Do his first name.
Jack Sharkey.
Jack Sharkey, yes, Sharkey. In 1932. Well, that was a pretty easy one. Here's a harder one. This comes from T.B. Clark of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Get 2 out of 3. This is about music. What music has been described as, quote, iteration of a duple beat against which syncopation is added? What music is that, Mr. Levant?
That's long hair, I think, for jazz.
Yes,
very unsuccinctly put.
Is it a good definition, would you say?
You know it isn't. Does it feel like jazz to you?
No. I could say it.
Say it again.
Iteration of a duple beat against which syncopation is added. No, it still doesn't sound
like jazz.
You can
tell he can't beat it out.
No, couldn't beat it out. Here's an easier one. Quote, music consisting of an underlying rhythmic ostinato against which the right hand plays a series of improvised melodic fragments.
Well, the melodic is quite...
You got that, Mr. Levant?
Swing.
No, that's not swing.
No, I don't think it would be.
That's boogie-woogie. That's the ostinato is a recurrent bass. That's the tip-off.
Bass played with the...
Usually tense in the left hand, rather slow tempo.
Righto. And here, the music consists of a simple harmonic basis supplied by the rhythm section with a solo instrument improvising a superposed melodic line.
Mr. Adams had that before.
Mr. Adams, would you like to answer that?
So wing.
So wing, right. That gives us 3 out of 3. And it sure makes that music sound dull, Mr. Levant. Mrs. Thomas J. O'Donnell of Baltimore, Maryland, sends us this. This is a question about odors. Smells to you, Mr. Levant.
Scent to me.
I'm going to read you some descriptive passages. Identify the works from which they come. Quote, a smell like a washing day. That was the cloth. A smell like an eating house and a pastry cook's next door to each other with a laundress's next door to that. That was the pudding. The quotation is from what work by whom? Any guesses, Mr. Kipp?
I guess Dickens.
You're right. And can you name the work?
One of his Christmas stories?
Yes, which one?
Old Tiny Tim?
Sure, its other name being...
A Christmas Carol.
A Christmas Carol. That's right, Mr. Kieran. Very good. It's the description of the smell of the pudding as it's brought in to the celebrants at the Christmas dinner. Here's another. Quote, they conveyed me into a buck basket. Do you know that already, Mr. Kieran? I was going to read the rest of it, which gives us the odor, but you tell us what it's from, and I'll read the rest of the quotation.
Why, that is from The Merry Wives of Windsor. That's rather oversized Falstaff describing how he was carried out in a washing basket.
That's right. And all I had to give you was the word buck basket.
That's all.
For you to get it. Good enough. It goes on, rammed me in with foul shirts and smocks, socks, foul stockings, greasy napkins. That there was the rankest compound of villainous smell that ever offended nostril from the Merry Wives of Windsor. Now here is the third of these scents, as Mr. Lafant elegantly reminds us. Quote, while he was thinking what he should say to his father, and wringing his hands over the smoking remnants of those untimely sufferers, an odor assailed his nostrils unlike any scent which he had before experienced.
Tristram Shandy.
No, Mr. Adams, no. A gallant guess, but a wrong one. Mr. Kieran.
That's a dissertation on roast pig.
A dissertation upon roast pig by whom?
By Charles Lamb.
Yes, that's quite right. That gives us 3 out of 3, with Mr. Adams coming in a little too fast on the last one. Now we have one from Kenneth McGowan, the famous stage and screen producer, now living in Beverly Hills, California. I'm going to give you some words that are generally used in pairs. Distinguish between the words. The first is beer and skittles. Distinguish between beer and skittles. We've all heard the phrase beer and skittles, Mr. Levant.
Well, beer you can get anywhere. Skittles you can only read about.
what is skittles? What are skittles?
Well, ninepins.
Yes, it's a game like ninepins, Mr. Adams. Mr. Levant, I think, was probably about to say that. Now, how about the pair of words lares and penates? Mr. Kieran?
Well, those are the household gods of the ancient Roman days.
And what...
Well, one was the god of the things that were sacred to the gods of the hearth, I believe. And the other was sacred to, around the house.
Well, that would be pretty much the same thing. Lares were the spirits of ancestors, and penates were the spirits of the storeroom or the hearth and home in general. Now, how about sock and buskin? Sock and buskin. Let's have a quick answer on that. Mr. Chair.
Well, the sock and buskin, the sock was the stocking that was worn, and the buskin was the shoe part that was tied around it.
Yes, and they depicted what different
characters. Oh, stage.
Yes, and which characters on the stage. One depicted what? Sock depicted comedy, and the buskin, tragedy. Now, I think that's all we have time for. Mr. Cross says that it's just as hard to get a real education in tobacco as it is to go through Yale or Harvard.
That's right, Mr. Fadiman. A great deal of special training is necessary before a man can become an expert tobacco buyer or auctioneer or warehouseman. Indeed, it may take him much more than 4 years of difficult apprenticeship in the tobacco warehouses before he rates as a real expert. Now, that's one reason why the judgment of these experts in the matter of cigarettes means so much to you. For they know tobacco from A to Z, and at auction after auction, they see who pays the price to get the finer, the lighter, the naturally milder leaf. Well, sworn records show that over twice as many of the independent tobacco experts, not connected with any cigarette company, smoke Lucky's exclusively as smoke all other cigarettes combined. Yes, with men who know tobacco best, it's Lucky's 2-to-1. Won't you profit by their experience in selecting a cigarette of finer, lighter, milder tobaccos? Lucky Strike.
Thank you, Mr. Cross. Tonight, Lucky Strike has sent out a total of $50 and 2 sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And thank you, Mr. Davidson, for lending your voice and your beard this evening to Lucky Strike's party. Next week, the Kieran Adams-Levant combination will serve him up, and our guest will be the brilliant American novelist and short story writer, John O'Hara, author of the book of the smash hit musical comedy, Pal Joey. Remember, listeners, for every question we use, whether or not it's answered correctly, the sender gets $10. If the question stumps us, you not only get 25 more, but in addition, the complete set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your letters with questions and correct answers to Information, Please, 480 Lexington Avenue of this city. And now a parting message from Mr. L.A. Speed Riggs, famous tobacco auctioneer of Goldsboro, North Carolina.
And that chant, fully interpreted, ladies and gentlemen, means Lucky's pay higher prices for the finer, the lighter, the naturally milder tobaccos. With independent tobacco experts, auctioneers, buyers, warehouse men, with men who know tobacco best, it's Lucky's 2-to-1.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.